Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is March 22nd, 2024, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Breathe: Simple Aspiration versus Drainage for Complete Pneumothorax. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Richard Malthainer. He holds the prestigious position of chair, head of the Division of Thoracic Surgery, and serves as the director of thoracic robotic program at Western University's Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry. Dr. Malthainer currently serves as the vice president of the Canadian Association of Thoracic Surgeons and is the founder of Skeptic Thoracic Journal Club. Welcome back to the SGM, Rick.
Thank you, Ken. It's good to be back at Moose Manor.
Yeah, here we are at Moose Manor, but I don't think we have to worry about any, what are they, C-130 aircrafts? Because every time we get together, and it's usually, summertime, we have these huge military aircraft fly overhead every time we're trying to record something.
Well, they might, but, with the snowstorm, they're probably grounded.
Yeah, I shouldn't speak too soon, because the plane will come along at any minute. I wanted to mention, though, you combine two of my favorite things: skepticism and the Nordic god Thor. Did you know that we have a dog named Loki, the dog of mischief?
Of course. Did you know I have a dog as well? His name is Siegfried Amadeus.
Amadeus?
Ziggy.
Ziggy? Yeah. Does play the piano, or does he have the eye-paw coordination?
Oh, back, over his shoulders with his tail. Fantastic.
So that's one talented dog. Our dog is dyslexic. That's why it's the dog of mischief, not the god of mischief.
All right,
let's get to a case for today's episode.
We have a 25-year-old female medical student who presents with right chest pain and shortness of breath. A chest x-ray shows a complete pneumothorax.
I love those really, really short case presentations. All right, you're my go-to person whenever I want to start talking about chest tubes, usually. The first time we got together, that was way back on SGM 129, and this is like number 433. So that episode had two questions. First question was in a trauma patient. How clinically useful is a chest x-ray after putting in a chest tube, Rick?
Well, the answer we came up with was put the chest tube in on the correct side and within the triangle of safety and obviously within the pleural space. Yes, it's important to get a chest x-ray post tube insertion, but it probably wouldn't change your management unless, of course, the patient is doing poorly or the tube is not draining.
Yeah, I really like that. Get it on the right side, and I don't mean right, I mean the correct side. Put the tube in the correct size, look for that triangle of safety, and then you're trying to hit the pleural space. And you should know, but we are going to get that chest x-ray, but it probably won't change management. The second question we had is, does a chest tube location matter? Because there was this sort of dogma in the past, go down if you're looking for fluid, put the chest tube up if you're looking for air.
Location, location, location. Yes, it does matter. If you safely put it in the correct side and in the pleural space, everything will be golden. The ideal location is posterior and up to the apex. That'll drain the fluid when the patient lies down and obviously drain the air when the patient sits up.
So there is location, location, location in real estate, but you're talking about location as the correct size, location in the triangle of safety, and then that third location, get it in the pleural space, and then you're trying to just fine-tune it if you're going posterior to the apex and stuff like that.
Correct.
Okay. Yep. Well, the next time we were talking tubular, it was not in a trauma patient, but rather in patients with their first large spontaneous pneumothorax, and that was SGM 300, and I used that image of that movie 300 for that episode. We only had one question on that episode, and we were asking if they all needed a chest tube. What was the bottom line for that one?
No, not everyone needs a chest tube. It is totally reasonable to use conservative management in some patients with a first-time spontaneous pneumothorax, if you can ensure that there's good, close follow-up.
Yeah, I guess that's probably applies to most medicine, so I'll try to avoid absolute, so not everyone needs one and not everyone doesn't need one. It all depends, and you're going to apply your clinical judgment in those cases. But sometimes I go outside of the old Rick Malfainer to get some chest tube advice because, you know, you're a busy guy. I understand you're off to Istanbul and Turkey coming up. So, you know, you're a hard guy to get on the show at times. So I've actually had another guest come on, and we looked at other chest-related issues with other guest skeptics. One of those episodes was SGEM 339, and we looked at the optimal anatomic location for needle decompression for tension pneumothorax, and that was with Dr. Rob Edmonds.
Yeah, that study did not support the claim that using the second intercostal space in the midclavicular line is thicker than the fourth or fifth intercostal space in the anterior axillary line, which, you know, totally makes sense. If you've got a big person, they're going to be big everywhere.
Yeah, and so if you've got a big person, use a big needle. And what I mean by big is a long needle, right? And if the person isn't of that size, then it probably really doesn't matter whether you're in the second intercostal space or the fourth or fifth.
Anatomically, probably doesn't matter. Again, personally, we tend to use the axillary space over the anterior space, mostly for cosmetic reasons. It leaves a scar, and sometimes those scars create a nasty keloid.
The most recent time we have explored something involving chest tubes on the SGEM was with guest skeptic Dr. Chris Root, and that was on SGEM 355. We wanted to know, does size of the chest tube matter in a hemodynamically stable patient with a traumatic pneumothorax?
In that study, which was a multicenter, non-inferiority, unblinded, randomized, parallel assignment comparison trial, reported small percutaneous catheters were non-inferior to large open chest tubes for traumatic hemothoraces.
Yeah, but I've got a real expert here. I mean, you're a thoracic surgeon and you're in charge of the thoracic program. So do you think it's reasonable to offer a pigtail catheter instead of that large bore chest tube, that big garden hose, for the evacuation of a traumatic hemothorax? And I'm going to throw in the caveat, the patient has to be hemodynamically stable.
I think it totally is reasonable, and it also depends where you are. If you're working in the community and you don't have a tube because of supply chain issues and you're not comfortable putting in a big tube, a little tube is better than no tube at all. And you always have the option of putting in a bigger tube. But ultimately, for trauma patients, because it's not just the pneumothorax, they're usually associated with hemothoraces and bleeding, a bigger tube is still better, in my opinion.
Well, patients can present with spontaneous pneumothorax. This worldwide ailment is defined as air in the pleural space between the lung and the chest wall with no obvious precipitating factor. It can occur in existing lung disease, secondary spontaneous pneumothorax, or with no known underlying lung pathology like a primary spontaneous pneumothorax.
Yeah, a chest tube remains the gold standard first-line treatment for primary spontaneous pneumothoraces. However, there are complications, and they can occur in up to 26% of cases. So a less invasive approach, such as simple aspiration, could be an option. The best way to manage primary pneumothorax in the first go still remains unclear as to what the best strategy is.
And we were talking a little bit before we started recording, and, you know, let's do a little time travel here. Doodle-doo, doodle-doo, doodle-doo. Way back when, you used to take a 60cc syringe with a three-way stopcock and a little angio cath and sit there as an intern taking off 60 cc's at a time, didn't you?
Yeah, been there, done that. I was taught by my chief resident at that time when I was doing my thoracic rotation to put in an angio cath in, three-way stopcock, and suck the lung back up. And even back, I won't say what year, not everyone needed a chest tube. Again, back in the day, we did not have small catheter tubes. We did not have pigtail catheters. The Seldinger technique for chest tube insertions was not an option. It was the garden hose that we put into everybody. And, you know, for these young patients who would come in with a little pneumothorax, a little needle, and a little aspiration, honestly, totally made sense. The downside, of course, it took a while to sit there and suck out all that air. But we spared them a big tube.
All right, let's get to the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's episode.
The clinical question is a simple aspiration non-inferior to chest tube drainage for first-line lung expansion in patients with complete primary spontaneous pneumothorax?
And what reference are we going to use?
It's Marks et al., simple aspiration versus drainage for complete pneumothorax, a randomized non-inferiority trial, American Journal of Respirology and Critical Care, 2023.
All right, let's run through the PCOT. What was the population that they were looking at?
Adults between the ages of 18 and 50 years with their first episode of a symptomatic, air quotes, complete spontaneous pneumothorax within the last 48 hours. And complete was defined as a total separation of the lung from the chest wall on chest x-ray.
And there were a number of exclusions, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention that they were looking at?
Yeah, so simple aspiration using a polyurethane safety catheter mounted on a blunt needle. The company is Terkel Thoracentesis Kit from Cardinal Health. It was placed in the second intercostal space, midclavicular line. They drained it freely for the first 15 minutes, then applied minus 25 centimeters of suction for 30 minutes. Then they clamped the tube, did a chest x-ray, and if the lung was up, the tube was removed. If the lung didn't come up, they sucked it out for another 30 minutes, and if it didn't come up, they put the patient on a drainage chest tube and the patient was admitted. All patients were monitored for at least 24 hours in the emergency department before sending them home.
Whoa, wait a minute. I gotta put a fine point on that. So they kept these patients, even if after the first, you know, they did the 15 minutes and then they did the 30 minutes and then they clamped it and took an x-ray. Oh, look, your lung's up. Took the tube out. But they kept even those patients in the emergency department for 24 hours?
Apparently so.
Where?
Yeah. I'm sure maybe it's different in France, but we can get to that later. That probably wouldn't fly here in our emergency departments. I mean, I don't know. I can speculate that maybe this was an ethics thing, that you're doing something that's a bit of an intervention, and perhaps for safety reasons, to make sure that patients weren't harmed, they needed to monitor them. It wasn't stated.
No, I can see that from the IRB's standpoint, the ethics approval. But boy, you know, we're overcrowded in the hospital because it's a hospital system problem. It's not just the emergency department, but that's where it shows up. That's where the bottleneck is. So keeping all of those patients for 24 hours for observation in the emergency department, that would be something. What did they compare it to?
It sounds like a standard chest tube. With the Vigon thoracic trocar drain, a 16 or a 20 French tube placed in the fourth or fifth intercostal space, mid-axillary line, and then it was hooked up to a Pleurivac drain or a BPDS 700 drainage system. I'm not familiar with that, but must be available in France. A chest x-ray was done while they were on suction, and then the rest of the care was done in accordance with the usual practices of that hospital.
So I like it. They took x-rays just to see if the procedure didn't suck.
That's what it sounds like.
All right, let's talk about their outcomes. What was their primary outcome of interest for this study?
A primary outcome was pulmonary re-expansion at 24 hours after the procedure. Failure was defined as a pneumothorax greater than 2 centimeters at the apex after either device was removed or needed drainage.
And how about their secondary outcomes?
There were several things like tolerating the procedure, adverse events, recurrence within 1 year.
And then the final part of the PCOT, that is the T. What type of study was this?
This was a prospective, open-label, randomized, non-inferiority trial conducted at 31 emergency departments at university and non-university hospitals in France from June 1st, 2009 to March 31st, 2015.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, first-line management of complete primary spontaneous pneumothorax with simple aspiration had a higher failure rate than chest tube drainage, but was better tolerated, less invasive, and they put it in quotes here, safer. So let's run through the quality checklist for RCTs, randomized control trials. First question, Rick, is the study population included or it focused in on those who present to the emergency department?
Definitely yes. Again, 31 emergency departments at university and non-university hospitals in France.
And the patients, do you think they were adequately randomized?
Yes.
And was the randomization process, was it concealed?
Yes. A randomization hotline was set up to allow the investigators at each hospital to do this around the clock, 7 days a week, using a phone call to a server. They used block randomization that was balanced at each hospital using block sizes of 4 to 6. And the management and the monitoring of the randomization was entrusted to a specialized company, ASCO Pharm.
Fourth question, the patients, were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes, they were. They did both a per-protocol analysis as well as an intention-to-treat analysis. This was very good.
All right, in the study, patients, were they recruited consecutively so that there was no selection bias involved?
I don't think so. They didn't explicitly say that, so you have to assume they didn't.
All right, the patients in both groups, were they similar with regards to prognostic factors?
It appears so. It's outlined in Table 1.
All right, how about the masking? Were all participants, that's the patients, the clinicians, and the outcome assessors, were they unaware of which group the patient was assigned?
So no, no, and yes. No to the patients, no to the clinicians, but yes to the outcome assessors. It was an open-label trial. There's no real practical way to mask a patient or physicians to which tube was placed into them. But there was a central review of the case reports and the x-rays, which was masked.
All right. All groups, were they treated equally except for the intervention, you know, the aspiration or the chest tube? Were they otherwise treated the same way?
I don't think so. They weren't very explicit on that, and they did say that, you know, certainly in the drainage group, they were treated according to the usual practices at each individual hospital, which obviously would vary, and we have no idea.
Okay, the follow-up, was it complete enough?
Again, I'm unsure on that.
All patient-important outcomes, were they considered?
I don't think so. Health-related quality of life assessments could have been done. They never asked the patients how they felt about the experience.
I think it would be really good, and I'm not sure if they did it, but, you know, in research, if you actually start with the patients at the methodology design stage and say, you know, what do you care about as a patient? What do you think is the most important thing? What do you look for when it comes to outcomes? Is it cosmesis? Is it pain? Is it duration of the tube? Can I go to work? Can I go to school? All these other things. Unless we ask patients from the very start, before we start designing the study itself and figuring out the methodology, ask them to be involved. I think that would be a great, and this is just a general statement. This isn't about this paper in particular.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, because here, you know, I don't know if a patient really cares if they have a 3-centimeter pneumothorax or a 1-centimeter pneumothorax, because they'll never be able to tell. And we're not even sure what a 2-centimeter pneumothorax do. Is that good enough? Or does it have to be 100% re-expanded? You know, patient-oriented outcomes are so important.
Yeah, I've never had a patient ask me those questions about how many centimeters. You've been doing, you know, chest tubes longer than I have. Has that ever come up?
No.
So it's you know, can I breathe? And when I'm breathing, do I not have pain? Or if I do, how much is the pain? Those types of things, and how much discomfort there is with the tube itself.
Yeah, and certainly for this intervention, asking patients, you know, how the process went, which one was better, would have been very valuable.
Yeah, and ask them if you had an option, because you were randomized. Were you happy with the group you were put in, or would you have preferred to be, you know, randomized to the other group?
Mm-hmm.
That might have been a nice question, too.
Yeah.
The 11th question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yes, but in an adverse way for the primary outcome.
Yeah, we're going to drill into that a bit, I think, when we're talking about non-inferiority margins and 25%. Is that reasonable or not to the patient or to the clinician? 12th question, where'd the money come from? Is there any financial conflicts of interest that you know of?
I didn't see any.
All right, let's get to the results then. They recruited just over 400 patients into the study. The mean age was 28 years. 82% were male and 60% were on the right side. What was the key result?
Simple aspiration was non-inferior to chest tube drainage for the first line lung expansion in patients with complete primary spontaneous pneumothorax and was better tolerated with fewer adverse events.
All right, let's dig into those outcomes. The primary outcome, this was that treatment failure that you talked about. Can you give us some numbers around that?
29% of the aspiration group had a treatment failure, while 18% of the chest tube drainage group had a treatment failure. That was a difference of about 11% with a confidence interval of 2.6 to 20%.
Yeah, so the delta was 11%. So more than a 10% difference in failure if you went with simple aspiration. All right, how about secondary outcomes?
Yeah, summarizing them, the aspiration group had less pain limiting breathing, less kinking of the device, but there was a greater recurrence of the pneumothorax. But were these differences clinically significant? And we will put the numbers in the show notes.
All right, it was a bit of a walk to get here, but it's time to talk nerdy. You ready to go?
Absolutely.
Okay, bring it.
So, first point, modifying the primary outcome. Dynamic analysis may be a legitimate, but is a red flag to be more skeptical. They explained in the manuscript, quote, the determination of an appropriate non-inferiority margin is critical to the demonstration of non-inferiority. Substantial discordance in the numerical inputs used for trial planning and the actual trial rates of the primary outcome during the interim analysis resulted in an unplanned reevaluation of the trial analysis. Beyond the fixed approach, many authors propose computational methods that allow margin recalculation during the analysis.
Yeah, that is a bit of a red flag for the old skeptical radar. Woot, woot, woot. And I mean, it's not that you can't change your methodology during a study, but boy, we got to look at that a little closer. And if they had a priori set up stuff about the interim analysis, and if the interim analysis said A, that we would do this, if it said B, a priori, we would do this. But this seemed to switch because of the interim analysis, and then they just unplanned a switch in their methodology.
I didn't like it.
Yes. I get that feeling.
Clearly.
Okay, so nerdy point number two. This is about statistical versus clinical non-inferiority. The difference between these two concepts is something we have identified before on the ASGEM, but it's usually when we're discussing superiority trials. It reflects how nuanced the interpretation of the medical literature can be. The authors say the study supports a conclusion of non-inferiority, but then they go on to say it does not support an interpretation of clinical non-inferiority. But this isn't a contradiction, and I'll put the actual quotes from their paper of those two things, saying, one, that from a primary outcome standpoint, statistically non-inferior, but not clinically non-inferior.
A treatment can be statistically non-inferior, but still may not be considered clinically non-inferior. We can't just look at numbers and not consider whether the statistical threshold translates into a meaningful clinical benefit. Also, there could be concerns about aspects of the treatment, such as the side effects, adverse events, or long-term outcomes that are not captured by the primary outcome of the study.
Yeah, the practice of medicine should not be based on numbers alone, or certainly not one number. This important concept applies to performing a simple aspiration in a patient with a pneumothorax. While aspiration does not perform statistically worse, and remember we said there was an 11% higher failure rate, an absolute 11% higher failure rate, but that wasn't statistically different from their non-inferiority margin, you also need to consider all factors relevant to clinical practice. This distinction is crucial in medical research and in the practice of clinical medicine, as it highlights the importance of considering the broader implications of statistical findings before making clinical decisions.
Nerdy point number three, determining the appropriate non-inferiority margin is confusing. Non-inferiority trials, in my opinion, are the devil's design. There's an excellent blog on this and post the link in the show notes. The non-inferiority margin determination is critical. In this study, the authors chose an event rate of 25%, not exceeding, in the drainage group. Where did this come from? This seems like an extremely large margin where patients consulted. Would an 11% rate, which is what they found, be considered non-inferior? The number needed to harm is 9. Then they changed their margin by using a, quote, synthesis approach. And then they changed it again using the moving rate of efficiency. Then they recalculated things, and truthfully, I was lost. And I'm sorry that my math skills are not up to the hand-waving and statistical voodoo of the authors.
Yeah, and so when you're doing all these different statistical manipulations, and I'm not saying they're being manipulative, I'm saying they're using different statistical methods to do something, but after the fact, it just makes me more skeptical. If there was a simple, clear answer, it would be obvious, as opposed to, okay, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, and then we've got to change this, and then we've got to change that. So that does make me a bit more skeptical. Nerdy point number four. Type of analysis for non-inferiority trials, and this is a big nerdy section for me, because there's been some debate around the best way to analyze a non-inferiority trial, with different methods having the potential to bias the results. Traditionally, a per-protocol analysis has been recommended. This analysis includes only those participants who adhere to the actual protocol and completed the treatment as assigned. This is considered the most conservative approach to assess non-inferiority, as it reduces the chance of bias towards non-inferiority due to protocol violations or dropouts. However, it may also introduce a different form of bias in the form of selection bias and reduce the generalizability of the results.
Another way to analyze a non-inferiority trial is to do an intention-to-treat analysis. This analysis includes all participants who were randomized, regardless of whether they received or completed the treatment as assigned. This is considered the most realistic approach to assess non-inferiority, as it reflects the real-world scenario and preserves the benefits of randomization. However, it also increases the chance of bias towards non-inferiority due to crossover, contamination, or loss to follow-up.
So you've got a per protocol, which is more conservative. You've got an intention to treat, which may be more realistic, more real world. But you can also do a modified intention to treat, or ITT analysis. This analysis is the compromise between the per protocol and the intention to treat analysis. It includes all the participants who were randomized and received at least one dose of the treatment, but excludes those who had major protocol violations or did not have any post-baseline assessment. This is considered a more pragmatic approach to assessing non-inferiority, as it balances this trade-off between the internal validity and the external validity. However, It may also introduce another type of bias or uncertainty depending on how the modifications are defined and implemented.
Ultimately, the choice of analysis for a non-inferiority trial should be based on the research question, the clinical context, and the statistical assumptions. Ideally, both a per-protocol and an intention-to-treat analysis should be performed and reported, and the results should be consistent and robust. If there's discrepancy between the two analyses, it should be explained and justified.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to see, the nuance, right? I'd like to see both up front, the per-protocol and the intention to treat. I don't want to go looking for it in a supplemental that I have to dig out and find and download separately. I want to see both in the original manuscript. And then, like you said, if there is a discordance between the two, then just talk about it and explain why that may have happened. But this gets us to our fifth and final point, and that is, with a question mark, what is safer? With any intervention, there can be potential benefits and potential harms. Both potential outcomes need to be considered when evaluating the net impact of any medical treatment.
Yeah, the authors claim that simple aspiration was safer, but they really didn't provide any data to support this. There really wasn't any safety outcomes reported. Their adverse event observed differences really don't appear to be different clinically. So I'm really uncertain if they can make the claim that it really is safer.
Yeah, and it's again how they define safe, right? Like what are they using for safety? Is more pain less safe? Like, is that how we're defining safety, based on pain? Kinking of a tube, is that defined as safety? So I guess, you know, maybe they're using a different definition than when we think, is it safe or not?
It could be that they're just lumping adverse events as safety.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, well, why don't we end the nerdy section there and comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions?
We generally agree with the author's conclusions.
Okay, generally agree, but can you give an SGEM bottom line?
Needle aspiration to treat first-time spontaneous pneumothoraces was statistically non-inferior to inserting a chest tube. It was better tolerated, but it did fail more often.
Yeah, and that's that 11% we were talking about. All right, how are you going to resolve this case of this young woman who came in with this, you know, quote, complete spontaneous pneumothorax on the right side?
Yeah, I would discuss the options of aspiration, tube placement, or simple observation. Patient thinks about it and prefers that, hey, you know, just keep an eye on me, and if something happens, then talk to me again. Fortunately, the patient remains stable. A chest x-ray is done in about 2 hours. There's no difference in the size of the pneumothorax. We discharge her home with good social support, clear instructions of what to do in case she develops any distress, to come back to the emergency department. And of course, we'll follow up with her with an appointment with her friendly thoracic surgeon the next day.
Yeah, I have in my notes that her friendly neighborhood thoracic surgeon, depending on your neighborhood. All right, so how are you going to take this study, though? Because it was done in France, so we're going to, you know, be thinking about external validity. And how are we going to apply that clinical study to our clinical practice, where you and I practice in Canada?
Yeah, well, this is something we don't routinely do in Canada. Now, I can't speak for the entire country, but certainly where we practice in southern Ontario, we don't aspirate pneumothoraces. We've learned from experience and previous studies that usually simple observation is often all that's needed. If you're going to insert a drain, well, what they did was they ended up putting a drain in all the patients. And in my opinion, if you're going to put it in a drain, you might as well put the guide wire in and put in a small chest tube and hook them up to a one-way Heimlich valve and send them home. I think the patient will be happier and more comfortable. And of course, it prevents the dreaded tension pneumothorax that we all fear.
And so your practice would generally be to, of course, do shared decision-making with them about, you know, whether you're going to put a tube in at all. But if you are going to put a tube in, you tend to put in a small tube with a Heimlich valve on it, and then send them home, you know, after a period of observation in the emergency department, make sure everything's okay. And then you send them home with close follow-up, either in the emergency department or if there's a thoracic thoracic service in your community.
Yeah, clearly it depends where you're working. If you have access to a surgeon, we're happy to see the patients. If you don't have access, then typically they would come back to your ER for another image the next day. And most of the time, you can get the tube out.
And so what are you going to say at the patient's bedside? How are you going to, you know, because this was a fairly complicated study with some changes in the methodology, some statistical stuff. We're not going to be usually talking to patients about those things. So how are you going to translate this to, quote unquote, English instead of doctor or medical terms at the patient's bedside?
Yeah, I would tell the patient that you have a collapsed lung, and traditionally we would put in a tube and put you on suction. But there are other options now, one of which is putting a tube in and aspirating the air out to get your lung to reinflate. Or sometimes we can just keep an eye on things and repeat an x-ray. And only if things get worse would we put in a tube.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener Contest winner, and that was Sean Murphy, a PA from Parry Sound. This is Sean's fourth win. He knew Sandra Bullock was wearing a Arizona Wildcat jacket in the movie Speed. Rick, what's the question this week?
What is the name of the genetic disorder that causes a pneumothorax, kidney cancer, and skin tumors?
Oh, like I know that. I'm going to have to search that out. But if you know the name of a genetic disorder that can cause a pneumothorax, a kidney cancer, and skin tumor, good for you, because I'm going to send you a cool skeptical prize. Thanks, Rick, for coming on over to Moose Manor, or the Bat Cave. It's got two names. Doing another tubular episode with me.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And we got through the whole episode without a large military aircraft flying over us.
Yeah, they're on other missions, I suspect.
They're not keeping such a close eye on you and I anymore. All right, one last thing. Can you read the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.